Good morning, and continuing with our theme for St. Patrick's Day, I'm Marianne Barasonic, and my guest is Gemma Whalen. She's an Irish theater director and educator right here in Portland. She's written a novel, Fiona, Stolen Child. Gemma, welcome to KBOO.
Thanks very much, Marianne. Thanks for having me.
Now, this is definitely an Irish novel. It's about the experience of this woman who spends part of her time in the U.S. and she's resolving issues from being in Ireland.
That's right, yeah.
Do you think that there is a specific genre of the Irish novel?
Oh, my God. That's a really big question. I'm not sure it's...
Might as well start out with
that. You start on the big scale. I mean, obviously, there's a long, rich tradition of Irish literature. You know, the Irish are famous for writing, actually. I mean, it's one of the areas in which they really excelled, as opposed to, say, the visual arts.
Do you think that's because the weather there is as bad as it is here?
I wouldn't be surprised. I think there's probably a connection. I do, actually. If you have to spend a lot of time indoors, you know, and then there are some people who say it's something to do with the Irish temperament, and which maybe the weather has something to do with. The famous Irish melancholy, or just spent, you know, lots of time thinking and, of course, talking in pubs and formulating ideas.
Boy, I've only been to Ireland a couple of times, but the life in the Irish pubs is just, it's something very, very different.
It is. It is. I mean, it's really a social place. I mean, that's not to say there isn't any, you know, problem with drinking, but traditionally it has been a place where people go, and they go for the company, you know, over a few pints or a few shots, and you know, and in the summer, like in the daytime, or say in late afternoons or early evenings, children come as well, and they play and they drink, you know, soft drinks and minerals, and there's music, and so it has been a place for an exchange of ideas.
It's very different than the feel that you have in bars and pubs here.
True.
In the U.S.
True.
And it seems to be a cultural thing. We have the drinking problem here. We just don't have all the camaraderie.
Yeah, maybe you need more Irish.
That's entirely possible. So, but getting back to my earlier questions, do you think that there is something like specific about the way a story is told that you could say, you know, this has kind of got an Irish flavor to it?
Well, I think definitely if I had to pinpoint something, I would say the language, you know, and of course that runs the gamut in terms of stylistics from, you know, two brilliant writers like James Joyce and one hand, and maybe Samuel Beckett on the other. And, you know, Joyce, who just wrote and wrote and wrote the sort of famous stream of consciousness and invented words and had how many different languages, you know, Latin and German and Italian and Irish in his head, and that all came out on the page. And then Samuel Beckett, who actually pared everything down to a sort of minimalism, but even in, say, something like Waiting for Godot or Samuel Beckett, they're incredibly poetic as well. So I think, I mean, if I had to pick something, since you're putting me on the spot, I would say language, maybe a kind of a lyricism.
Well, you know, that makes sense with the kind of tradition of Irish music. It seems like Irish music is much more a part of day-to-day life.
It is. It is. And you grew up with it. I mean, I think a lot of people grew up with it in the homes. You know, I certainly grew up with a lot of Irish, with a lot of music, I should say. A lot of Irish as well. There were eight of us and my parents. But we always had music. You know, my dad actually played about eight instruments and completely self-taught. There was always singing. Several of us played instruments. And then when people came, you always did, you know, when visitors came, like the cousins or the aunts or something, or everybody was expected to have a party piece, and that you didn't have to be able to sing. So it could be singing, but if you couldn't sing, for example, my older sister Anne is not able to sing, but she was great at recitations, as we called it. So she would learn poems or, you know, short stories that she would tell. Very short. I mean, Yeah, so there was a sense of a sense of performance.
Right, and it's very different from the idea that we have of music here, where music here is something that is performed by someone else, and your role in it is to appreciate it.
That's right. Whereas very much the Irish like to join in.
Right.
They really do like to join in. And a lot of Irish parties, including ones over here, you know, at least many that I've had or my Irish friends have had, particularly in the Bay Area, which is where I lived for many years, they always ended up in, we'd always say, bring your instruments to your friends. They didn't have to be Irish, obviously. All of your friends wouldn't be Irish. But people would bring their instruments and play and sing, and the end of the evening would be maybe singing for several hours.
Right. I was put on a spot in Ireland where we were in a pub and everybody is going around and, you know, all the Irish people were singing these beautiful ballads and, you know, and they come to me and first of all, I can't sing and then try to remember words to songs. And it was terrible.
That's very embarrassing. It's hard because they put you on the spot.
Right.
And they put pressure on you as well. Like they're not necessarily very nice about it.
Right. But up until that point, wow, it was a lot of fun.
Well, next time, Marianne, you have to have a poem or something. Do you know what I mean? Because it really is fine. People like, I think it's the words and the idea that you're participating.
Well, and there's so much lyricism in poetry that it's, and so I could see that as being the characteristic of what would be an Irish novel is the lyricism in the words because of the music background. Now, the woman, Fiona, who's the book is about, is she spent her childhood during the Troubles. And I think one of the other characters mentions that he thinks that's wonderful because it's so understated. And, it's basically, it was open warfare, but everybody called it the Troubles.
The Troubles, I know. Yeah, Fiona, she was a child young child in the 1960s. But then there's one of the, several of the scenes you're referring to is when she's a teenager, later teenager in school. Because 1968 and 69 is when the Troubles, erupted in Ireland with the civil rights marches. And Fiona, I think it's Fiona that makes the comment is like, it's typical Irish understatement, calling something like that was, basically the place was ravaged for 30 years.
Now, were you there during that time?
I was, yes. In fact, I was in secondary school and then I was in college in Trinity. And this was in the 70s when I was in college. And so, I was on, marches and when I was in college. And also there were bombs. I mean, the whole time that I was in college in Dublin, I can't remember sitting through a film every time you went in to see a film, for example, there might be a bomb scare. And there were loads of films I didn't see the end of because the cinema would have been evacuated. And there was one really bad case of a bombing at the back. Trinity would have been considered a bastion of British imperialism. It was founded by Queen Elizabeth in the 1590s. I think 1580, well, something like that, in the 16th century. And so it was targeted. That's what they did. The IRA was targeted in this case by the IRA. So there was a big bomb scare. I was studying one night in the library and I thought the ground started to move. There was this explosion and it would have been my idea. I had not yet experienced an earthquake because I hadn't been to San Francisco or another part of the world where they have earthquakes. So I thought it was an earthquake, but Ireland doesn't have earthquakes. And it was a bomb, and it was at the back gate of Trinity, and there were loads of people killed. I mean, we were kept on campus for hours. There was no telephones, couldn't get through. It's almost secondhand. I mean, that's Dublin. I'm living in Dublin. Of course, it has nothing to compare to
what was going on
in the north.
Yeah.
Living through.
And there's a mention of Trinity in the book because Fiona is going to go there, and it's very controversial because every aspect of everyone's lives is divided between whether you're on the Catholic side or the Protestant side.
That's right. And remember, this is the South, which is a lot of people say, it has nothing to do with the North. I mean, of course it has, but most of most of the violence was contained in the North, not all. But the ideas were there, and of course there was a huge, I was brought up like this in school, and the sense of you're taught Irish history. And of course, in Catholic Ireland, you're taught it from a nationalist point of view. So that's what you were supposed to believe, and that's the side that you were supposed to be on, right? The United Ireland, the idea of a United Ireland. And it's a sort of, it's a nationalist, it's an ideal, it's going back hundreds of years because that's what your forebears fought for and died for. So that's the angle. And then because of that, there's the other side of that is hating the British, or, you know, sort of a black and white view of the world. And I mean, that's one of the things I have Fiona, the character, she protests against, because her father would have been, her father, of course, an old school, an older generation, and he's quite biased against, she has a, Fiona ends up having a Protestant boyfriend. He's in the south of Ireland, you know, as she says, his parents are here for hundreds of years, but her father still considers him an outsider and a Protestant, and of course connects him to what's going on in the north and the violence of the Protestants against the Catholics.
And he's considered an outsider because he's considered British, even though his family's been there for hundreds of years?
Yeah, he would have been considered Anglo, you know. So, yeah, I mean, he probably would have been considered Irish, but, you know, Protestants were considered, and some of them, by the way, were not very well off, but they often lived in these big houses because they were, they were really the relics, they were the remnants of the Protestant ascendancy. And they were grand mansions. They were built as beautiful mansions, but people ran out of money and didn't have money for upkeep. So a lot of them, I mean, to this day, they were crumbling. But there's still a great, there was still a divide. And well, they were the, and there was often an estate that went with it, you know, and sometimes there was a gamekeeper. So this is in contrast to the Irish, you know, the I suppose, the people who were descended from the peasants, because historically what happened was the land was taken away during the plantations from the native Irish and given to the British.
Right, but it is an amazing testimony to the spirit of the Irish people that they do not give up.
That's very true. They are very dogged, I'd say, or bloody-minded. Yeah, and that's, you know, they've had these things. I mean, you know, we talk about the songs and you talk about the talk, and I think that's probably one of the things that sustained them. Of course, one of the other things that sustained them was religion was, you know, a very strong, I mean, the Irish are famous, at least in the past. This has totally changed now. But of being very strong Catholics and a huge allegiance to Catholicism and faith. That it would, you know, that it would work out.
Right. Do you think there's any link between, like, the pantheon of saints in Catholicism that links it to the older religions in Ireland that were probably
pagan
and mm-hmm. taken away when the Catholics came in?
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, the Irish, so even though there's this, I mean, on the one hand, there's, I mean, I would have said in the past a blind allegiance, you know, very, very, very strong connection. But then there's the sense of anarchy, which is a very Irish thing as well.
How do you mean the sense of anarchy?
Is just not accepting everything that you're given. So even though St. Patrick arrived, you know, with a nice package and converted everybody to Catholicism, actually the stories that are famously told is that he was very clever, and he actually did it by not trying to wipe out their pagan and Druidic origins. He incorporated what was there. And that's a mistake many other, because it was missionary, right? He was a missionary. Many other missionaries, they sometimes go to places and they're like, stop, you can't do this. For example, the British did that with the Irish language. You know, they tried to kill the religion, and they tried to kill the language as well. And Irish people were forced to start speaking English overnight. So, which today we'd probably consider a mixed blessing, because, you know, because we speak a brand of English anyway. and the Irish did disappear. I mean, it didn't disappear completely, and it's still, you know, it's still there, and there have been all sorts of revivals. But they held on to the religion. They held on to the religion in secret, you know, and they sent away their priests. So, but I do think there's, so back to the anarchy, it's like, the Irish are very, I suppose, bloody-minded is the word that just came up. It's revolting against authority. You know, they don't like to accept authority. And it's the fighting aspect of it. And So definitely, I mean, I don't know if you know Brian Friel's play Dancing at Lunasa, right? It's one of his most famous plays, and it got made into a film, as a matter of fact. I mean, it's a beautiful stage play, but it was also a film. Meryl Streep, actually, was in it. So, but there's a dance in there. It's an Irish dance. You know, it's a traditional Irish dance that happens. It's a group of sisters, and it's set in Donegal. And the dance starts as, like, you know, a nice, well-behaved Irish dance, which is they're supposed to be. You know, this is, if you look at Irish dancers, they stand very straight and they hold themselves. And then it devolved, I suppose you could say, into this pagan celebration. And to me, that just that one, that dance, that moment in this particular play represents the cracking of the surface, you know, of this, the just the abandon and the just love of celebration and life and just the largeness of spirit that's there that religion tried to clamp down on, organized religion tried to clamp down on. So I think the two things are going on simultaneously.
Okay, you're listening to Between the Covers. I'm Marianne Barasanic. My guest is Gemma Whalen, and we're talking about her novel, Fiona, Stolen Child. Do you go back to Ireland frequently?
I do. I go back. I mean, I've gone back about every year and a half to 2 years, traditionally. That it's been probably the last time I was back now was 2008, which is also happens to be the year I moved to Portland. Oh. But my mother died that year, and so my parents are both dead now. So that changes the equation, right. You know. But my sisters and one of my sisters just moved to England, so I have one sister there. But I'm very close to her, and I have brothers there and nieces.
Okay,
and very good friends. Some of them going back to when I was very young.
So you're probably very familiar with what's going on a day-to-day basis as far as, like, the financial crisis.
Oh, yes.
Now the troubles have become these financial troubles.
Oh, it's dire. It's really, really bad. I mean, the country is bankrupt. It really is. And everybody is affected. Everybody is affected. I mean, I don't know the intimate, you know, day-to-day details, but I do speak to, I mean, I spoke to my sister just yesterday, and people's pensions have been cut. They're, you know, things that they thought they could depend on, and they worked their whole lives for. So, so on both ends of the spectrum, obviously, say younger people starting out who have mortgages, I mean, they have the same problems that people have here, you know, and raising their kids and so on. And then on the other end, people who are retired or just, apart from the portfolios or any sort of retirement stocks or bonds, they have crashed. And the government just slashed. I mean, they're just off the top. They're just slashing because there's no money.
Right. But it's almost like there was only a short period of time when there was a lot of prosperity in Ireland.
The Celtic Tiger.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, before that, Ireland was always struggling. It's kind of like they've just gone back to where they were before.
Yes, yes. It's except now they know what it's like to have things. You know, it really was. I mean, Ireland was a very poor country in the Ireland, really up until the 90s, you know. So it's very, very recent. I mean, sort of the late 90s that the so-called Celtic Tiger, and it was really strong and booming and the country was going crazy. And, you know, it's the first time since the famine in the 1840s that the population of Ireland increased. And this is with people.
Really?
And people had 8 to 10 to 12 children, and the population never managed to increase because they all left. They had to leave Ireland. I mean,
so it wasn't that the infant mortality rate was so high. It was because there was so much out-migration.
Exactly, exactly. And Ireland, in starting sometime in the late 90s, I don't know the exact date, but, you know, coincident with the boom, Ireland actually had the lowest birth rate in Europe. So that's an astounding, for somebody who grew up in Ireland when I did, like, that's an astounding statistic. And it was one point something.
It was the prosperity that brought the lower birth rates.
Prosperity, I mean, it was, you know, education, and women were working. And they also had choices, and they weren't blindly obeying everything they were told to do by the Pope. So obviously they were using birth control. So, you know, yeah, things have, I mean, the country changed.
It's interesting, the Fiona in the book, she has a very hard time taking credit for anything that she's done. There's this idea that, you know, pride is a sin and you shouldn't be. So do you see that as something that is an inherently Irish trait, or is it Catholic? And has that changed with the prosperity?
Changed, utterly changed.
Really?
To quote Yeats. Yes, everything, it's completely different. You know, there's maybe some of it is coming from, you know, if you're part of a family of 8 or 10 or 12 or 6, and there isn't that much money and there's a lot. But some of it had to do with the way that it's culture and the way children were thought of. You know, the phrase, children should be seen and not heard. I mean, that was very much part of the ethos. And you weren't in school, you learned things off by heart. You know, you weren't encouraged to ask questions. You weren't expected to have an opinion if you were a child. And so Fiona is very much of that ilk. You know, she grew up, and then because of other things that happened to her, and because she was sensitive, she really internalized that. So, but today, no. I mean, I look at my nieces and nephews and children in school today. Their value, their opinion is valued. They definitely have a voice. It's more like it is here, for example, I think.
Right, right. So it's this culture, you think, has seeped into there?
Yes, you could say that. I mean, I think probably American culture has seeped in everywhere, hasn't it?
Yes.
You know, but you know, there are good and good parts. I mean, I think it's a really good thing to have pride in yourself and to believe that you're worth something and that your opinion is worth something. So and not to be downtrodden. I mean, there's nothing romantic about that at all, and there's nothing positive about it. And I'm not talking about humility. You know, I'm talking about, see, that's the thing. It's sort of a black and white interpretation of what pride is, right? Because we all, I mean, you know, the Dalai Lama tells us, but we all know it's good to be humble. And then, you know, the Greeks certainly suffered for hubris and overweening pride. But I think somehow the Irish Catholic mind just took this, because it's one of the seven deadly sins, you know, pride is one of the seven deadly sins, that if you put notions into a child's head that they were really good, that they would get a big head, they would get a swelled head, and they would, there's, you know, some of it, this is Irish thing of like keeping people down as well, you know, and you don't want to rise above your station. I mean, I'm throwing out some phrases now that I would have heard throughout my childhood. And even, yeah, even among some Irish Americans in this country, you know. So as opposed to the opposite of that is that you can, of course, be confident and think well of yourself. And it doesn't mean that you know, you're a bully or think you're better than other people.
Now, your background is in screenplays, isn't it?
It's most of my background actually is in theater. I'm a theater director. But I did also then segue into film in the mid-90s, and I did an MFA in cinema, and I wrote screenplays. And Fiona actually started as a screenplay.
So how do you think that background has influenced your writing?
I think a lot of people actually tell me that this is my first novel, so I'm new to novel writing. And so a lot of people tell me it's very visual, and I think I do see things, you know, I imagine. I visualize things when I'm writing. And also I hope it has helped me in terms of structure. I mean, one of the great things you get from screenwriting is you learn, you know, it's basically Aristotelian structure. It's beginning, middle, and end. There's nothing mysterious about it, but it's a good thing to get a grasp of so that you can, in terms of just orchestration and shaping.
Right, the structure.
The structure, yeah.
My guest today has been Gemma Whalen, and we've been talking about her book, Fiona, Stolen Child. I believe you're going to be doing some readings around town here. Is that correct?
Well, I've actually done quite a few, but I have one later today. It's not a reading so much. And the information is on my website, by the way, which is fionastolenchild.com. It's at the Ambridge Cultural Centre, and it's organised by the All-Ireland Cultural Society. And it's a great St. Patrick's Day celebration if people want to check it out. It's from 4 to 8:30, and there's music and dancing, and I have a booth there.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for coming in. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much, Marianne.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Movie Talk with Ed Goldberg, DK Holm, and Becky Olson. Thank you, KBOO members, for your support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on the tip jar.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Laurelhurst Theater and Pub, independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads and wraps, and all new seating. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
Good morning and happy St. Patrick's Day to all of us unofficial Irish out there and the real ones too. This is Movie Talk. We're on once a month talking about films, especially independent and small films at the theaters around town that serve art films. But we also talk about the blockbuster from time to time. I'm here with my colleagues.
Becky Olson.
And?
DK Olm.
Okay. And one Romanian Jew and two Scandinavians here on St. Patrick's Day. We have a few movies to talk about, but first we have an announcement. There's a Charlie Chaplin series at Northwest Film Center. Is there anything yet that hasn't been said about Charlie Chaplin?
No, I guess we're done for that topic.
Well, it's almost a cliche to talk about. If you've never seen Charlie Chaplin, you should always see a Charlie Chaplin film. There's a couple that veer into sentimentality, but that was later in his career. The early stuff, especially the silent stuff, is funny and anti-authoritarian, and Chaplin was a committed lefty who paid for his politics later on in life.
And one good thing with this bunch of films is that it's Chaplin's, in some cases, Chaplin's original music as opposed to some tinkly piano score that's lobbed on without any sense of what's happening on the screen, which all too often happens with older silent movies, you know, when they were releasing 60mm back in the...
Yeah, that's another thing. As Chaplin wrote the film scores for most of his films, especially later on. Okay, let's start with the BAM Fest. Becky, you're going to tell us about the BAM Fest?
Sure. I should also probably just quickly mention that since it's St. Patrick's Day, tonight at the Hollywood, if you really want to, you can go see Leprechaun, the film debut of Jennifer Aniston, among other things.
Really?
Okay. Super exciting.
Is she wearing her famous hairdo? I don't know. Okay, go ahead.
Anyway,
tell us about the BAMFest.
So BAMFest, this weekend, this is the festival that is mostly run by Aaron Mesh at Willamette Week and a few other people I don't really know. So, this weekend they're showing the British Zombie Massacre Doghouse and George Romero's Day of the Dead Friday and Saturday at St. John's Cinema at 10 o'clock and midnight, respectively. And there's also something kind of odd that they're doing, which is there's a giant, like, 9-foot metal robot hosting a music and multimedia performance thing at the Wonder Ballroom on Saturday. So I think their website is bamfestpdx.com. So
I was starting to think, what's weirder than a British zombie movie? Not
right.
You did it. All right. Have you seen any of these films or
any of which?
Of the BAMFest films.
I've seen Day of the Dead a long time ago.
Oh, Day of the Dead. No, yeah. That's a terrific movie. Okay. Yeah. Let's start with the Adjustment Bureau. The Adjustment Bureau is... Let's see. It's taken from a Philip K. Dick story, but it's really, really loosely based on the Philip K. Dick story. It's really not a whole lot like it, except for the central theme. It's directed by a guy named George Nolfi. Anybody knows what this guy's done before? No? Okay.
I knew at one point, and I'd already forgotten.
Yeah, okay. It doesn't matter. It stars Matt Damon, Emily Blunt, who's rapidly becoming one of my favorite actors, Anthony Mackie, John Slattery from Mad Men, and Terrence Stamp. From
The Limey.
Yeah, he's. I love Terrence Stamp. Yeah. Okay. Again, this is a Philip K. Dick story, so the two things you're going to know about it are that it's anti-authoritarian and paranoid, because that's pretty much what Philip K. Dick's oeuvre was all about. It's a David Norris is the character that Damon plays. He's a rising politician in New York, a congressman from Brooklyn that they see big things for, but he keeps putting his foot in his mouth. He keeps doing dumb things. Things keep coming back from his raucous past. He's his own worst enemy, in other words. And in the process of all this, he runs into a young woman played by Emily Blunt. Her name is Elise, and they kind of hit it off. Then suddenly things begin to go sideways, and he's trying to figure out what's going on. But unbeknownst to him, there is a organization called the Adjustment Bureau that is really running all of our lives. It's sort of like a Matrix idea where you think everything is cool and you have freedom of choice, but no. So he goes so far off the plan, quote-unquote the plan, that they have to tell him of the existence of the Adjustment Bureau and tell him he's got to conform or else. And that's really basically what the film is about. When he stops conforming purposely because he really wants to get together with Blunt, which is not on the plan. And then they send Terrence Stamp after him, who's the enforcer. He's the big enforcer. I really enjoyed this film. I thought that Damon played his youthfulness and that side of him in this. Emily Blunt is just wonderful. She plays a modern dancer in one of those downtown no-money dance troupes. Everything in the story worked for me. Yeah, it's a little creaky in places, and it's not a great movie, but Damon is good. Blunt is good, and all of the Slattery and Terrence Stamp are good. It's a B-plus film for me. Doug?
Well, I just looked it up. Nolfi wrote some screenplays for movies that Matt Damon appeared in, so I guess they struck up a friendship or a collaboration of some kind. But I like the movie less than you did because I think that they play well together, but the implications of the movie are so ludicrous, the concept of, it has nothing intelligent or interesting to say about predestination or and it's very vague about who these people are, are they angels or aliens? And if they are, they're not very competent since it turns out that, they're meant to be together, but they just messed up. It's Slattery is okay in that his patented Mad Men role of sort of, quiet exasperation, and some of his jokes are funny. But for the most part, it's a kind of a misadvertised movie. It's actually a romantic comedy, or it's a romance story tricked
up
as a sci-fi tale. So the advertisements are really misleading. So if one walks away with anything from this review, it should be that the people who think that they're getting one thing from the trailer are actually getting something totally different.
Yeah, I agree. It is a romance, and I think that's the thing I like best about it, is that the story is mostly about this couple that has everything thrown in their path to keep them apart, and love wins out in the end. So, I kind of like that about it. You want to give it a letter grade?
No, it's a C, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah, just a C.
Just a C.
But not, don't see it. It's just a C.
Okay, well, all right. Battle Los Angeles is the next film. This is a horse of a different color. Starts Aaron Eckhart, Michelle Rodriguez, and an enormous cast of people. Directed by a guy named Jonathan Liebesman. And this is one of those movies. It's a science fiction film about aliens invading the Earth. Okay, so it steals from War of the Worlds both the H.G. Wells and the Orson Welles version. It steals from District 9. It steals from, half a dozen other
Independence Day?
Independence Day, absolutely. And then that little cheapy Monsters that came out last year where the aliens are in Mexico and they're trying to get back to the United States from Mexico. And that was a much better film, and it cost about 1/27th what this movie cost. You know, Eckhart's fine, and I love Michelle Rodriguez, and everybody else in the movie is okay. But here's the story. It not only does it borrow from those other films, it doesn't do anything with what they take. They don't enhance it. They don't ennoble it. They don't change it in any creative way. And then the worst thing it does is it recreates one of those World War II Dream Platoon films where they used to have, you know, a Brooklyn Jew and an Italian guy in the platoon. Well, now the ethnic groups have changed, but it's basically the same thing. The diversity is there, but it's now Asians and Hispanics and people like that. And Eckhart plays a sergeant who's about to retire and has a checkered past because people think that he killed his last platoon because of his own cowardice or ineptitude. And he has to save the Earth from these aliens with this group of – this platoon that really doesn't like him very much. Plus, there are civilians involved because, you know, they're trying to save these civilians. And the thing is a freaking mess. I really, really – I watched this film and I said – what a thumping bore this is. What a ridiculous, stupid CGI nothing it is. It's not an F film because it's really not that terrible. It's just excessively mediocre. So I give it a D.
I liked it a little bit more than you did. You know, most science fiction movies of this ilk are really war stories anyway, you know, and all that whole line of science fiction from E.E. Doc Smith, all the way down to the Star Wars movies, which are sort of derived from the Doc Smith books. But in any case, they're just tricked up war stories where the weaponry and the enemies are subject to somebody's heightened imagination. And also, you get a lower MPAA rating if you're just blowing up an alien CGI thing instead of another human being. But all that being said, I actually thought this was kind of an interesting movie because, I mean, it is jingoistic and somewhat predictable in its allusions, but it nevertheless had some kind of difficult things to say about the impact of past, you know, unlike the Adjustment Bureau, it said sensible things about the impact of the past on your present, and also how... you know, the roots of heroism and sort of a critique of it, too, because, I mean, there's this one famous moment where one of the characters attributes something that Aaron Eckhart does as a real John Wayne move. And that was criticized in various reviews as being not doing anything with the idea of John Wayne. But in fact, they actually talk about it for another minute or two. You know, what does it mean to be a John Wayne type? And do you really like doing it? Or do you have any choice? It was actually a somewhat truncated, yes, but interesting discussion about it. So it wasn't as brainless to me as many of the other reviewers thought it to be. But in any case, it's not perfect. I give it a B, but not, you know, a qualified B because, you know, it is, a war movie. And it's sort of pro-war because America is actually being invaded, and you know it's like what Iraq would be if it came to America is basically what it's about. But in any case, I give it a B.
Yeah, one of the reasons they're talking about John Wayne is the younger people in the platoon have never heard of John Wayne.
Right.
Okay, so that was Battle: Los Angeles. Hall Pass. Now, I didn't see Hall Pass, but Doug, you did. Did you take a bullet for the team or what?
Well, it's not as execrable as you think, although it's. It's by the Farrelly brothers, who are famous for There's Something About Mary and that bowling king,
Kingpin.
And the cloacal nature of their early humor is sustained a little bit in this movie. But like Kevin Smith and the Apatow movies and various others, they start out being very rebellious and sophomoric and transgressive, and then I guess as they get married or whatever, or just realize that they need a PG rating in order to make lots more money, their movies become so tame and conservative. And the theme of this movie is even if your wife gave you a week off from the marriage in order to pursue other women and do whatever you wanted, you wouldn't do it because deep at root, even though you're a sophomoric, childish gawker and lech, you still are secretly dependent upon that relationship. And so this movie puts these two guys through their ridiculous paces. And then some of it's amusing. It's a better put-together movie than the other ones that have come out lately, like that Adam Sandler movie, Big Babies or Grown-Ups.
So,
yeah. And but it's a whole theme in comedy these days. I don't recommend it. I mean, it's just average stuff. If you're a Farrelly Brothers fan, it's worth seeing. But again, I would warn you that it's just, it's so embraces middlebrow mediocrity and conformism that it's odd coming from them, you know. The two brothers who have been wanting to make a Three Stooges movie for a decade have now lapsed into these tame, you know, predictable jokes about marriage. And in any case, it's got a good cast. It's well done. But again, it's so tame and dull. I give it a C. Mm-hmm.
Funny you should mention Kingpin, because to me, that's their masterpiece. I thought that movie was so subversive and vile and funny that it's my favorite
and
movie.
And it's Randy Quaid's last good performance.
Absolutely, yeah. Okay, so that was Hall Pass. Okay, I guess I'm the only one who saw Beastly, eh? Mm, all right.
Yeah, I didn't. Okay. You took the ball.
Can you pretend that you saw it?
I would be happy to.
you can pretty much predict what it is. It's directed by a guy named Daniel.
That's right. Why should we see these movies? We almost, except that the Adjustment Bureau is totally different from its trailer, and we need to be there to warn the listeners of that, and that's why you should support Movie Talk next time the pledge drive starts. Go ahead, please.
From your mouth to God's ears. Okay. This is a Disney factory film. I don't even know if it comes from the Disney factory, but everything about it smells of Disney. It's a guy named Alex Pettifer. Anybody know who this guy is? I never saw him before.
Pettifer, is that legal? I don't
think so. Well, not in this state, anyway. Vanessa Hudgens is in it. Lisa Gay Hamilton, who's actually pretty good, and Neil Patrick Harris, who's one of the lives of the film. But the real surprise here is Mary-Kate Olsen is in this film, playing a witch. I'll get to that later. And she looks like she dresses from Dr. John's garbage can, you know, like all the outfits that he threw out when he was walking on Gilded Splinters. She's dressed in all of those rags. But it's Beauty and the Beast, as you might suspect from the title. And this Alex Pettifer plays a guy named Kyle, who's a smug, arrogant, prep school creep, you know, handsome, debonair, totally disdainful of everybody, hot with the girls, all this kind of thing. And he annoys Mary-Kate Olsen, who plays the witch. She's a witch, functioning witch in the high school. And so she puts a spell on him and makes him ugly. So here's what ugly means. He has scars on his face. He has tattoos on his face. He's got something that looks like somebody took liquid solder and poured it down his nose, and it made a kind of a tree.
It sounds like he'd be more popular.
I looked at this guy and I said, this guy would never lack for a date in Manhattan. If Lower East Side, East Village, Soho, he would be at a party every night and the women would be falling off of him. But he is ugly. And he is banished to Brooklyn. Oh, my God. And in the company of the housekeeper, who's Lisa Gay Hamilton, and his blind tutor, Neil Patrick Harris, who has all the funny lines in the film. Vanessa Hudgens is another girl from his high school that he kind of likes, but she's beneath his station, you know. But somehow they get together. I don't remember how it is. And he decides that he's in love with her, but he's ugly. So, it's Beauty and the Beast, right? Well, here's the thing. The heart of the Beauty and the Beast story is that at some point, Beauty betrays the Beast. She takes the rose and she runs back to see her father, and Beast pines away almost to death for her.
That's right, yes.
That's missing from here. That's terrible. You can't have that. Girls will cry if you put that in here. Because the Beast will look like a bad guy. She will look like a bad girl. Well, this is Vanessa Hudgens, and her range of emotions runs from A to A+, maybe, not even to B. She does okay in this part because she's not called upon to do anything. This is a Disney Channel fan movie only. It's not going to hurt you to go see it. And if you're, a tweener of either sex, you'll probably like it. But if you're a grown-up, you're going to groan all the way through it. That's the definition of a grown-up now.
If the witch wanted to make him ugly, she should have turned him into a movie reviewer. we are a misshapen lot.
I resent that. Becky's adorable. Okay, it's a C-minus film at best. You know what it is? I mean, if you have a 12-year-old, that's probably okay for them. There's nothing bad in it at all. There's nothing really good in it at all. Okay, that's Beastly. There's also, at the Northwest Film Center, a group of French noir films. Now, I didn't get a chance to see any of these, but what's going on with these? Doug, can you tell us a little about
it? Well, I do know that Rafifi is in it.
And great movie.
Touche something Grisby. I can neither remember the words nor pronounce them correctly, but that's another great heist movie, I think, set in the world of nightclubs. The Sicilian Clan, yep. which I've never seen, and also a couple of Melvilles. Le Cercle Rouge is one, and a few others. So it's going throughout the whole month of March, I think, on weekends. I'm not sure, but you can always go to northwestnwfilm.org for the details. You've seen most of these movies too, haven't you?
Not most, just but I have seen Rififi, which is amazing.
It's an amazing film.
Yeah.
And one of the most influential heist movies ever. I mean, if you remember Top Copy, it's almost a direct cop from Rififi.
Given that the same director made both movies.
Ah, that's true.
Jules Dassin,
yeah, who was in Europe because he was blacklisted. Is Pepe Le Moco in the series?
I don't think so.
I don't recall
it being there.
The French do this almost better than anybody. It's without having seen the films or really knowing all the whole things and the whole lineup, it's probably worth your time to go see some of these movies. Just, choose them a little carefully. Okay, now I didn't see Black Death, Doug, but you did.
Yeah, is it even playing here? I don't know if it's here yet.
I don't know either.
Well, there's been this trend. Well, in case it ever comes to town, here's a brief review, and that is that, Becky and I are quasi-fans of this whole medieval chase film or journey film. You liked Valhalla.
Yeah.
And there's been a few others. The Eagle was one most recently, and... And
Centurion,
also,
if that
Centurion
counts.
Was yeah. a good one from Neil Marshall, yeah. or goodish one. It has goodishness to it, and and most recently the Nicolas Cage Howler Season of the Witch, which Black Death resembles the most because in both cases it is about a group of knights going from one place to another to fetch a assumed witch and bring her back. But in this context, they're trying to prevent the Black Death, although they're trying to fetch her for kind of stupid reasons that I'll leave for the viewer to find out. I thought this was going to be another tedious journey film, just like Season of the Witch, in which the journey part is the most uninteresting part of the movie. Only the beginning and only the end actually matter, like a basketball game.
Or a season.
It turns out to be really, really interesting because the journey parts of the movies actually validate the theme, this dire worldview that the film is portraying. And then, even better, at the end of the movie, there are a series of really subtle surprises which completely undermine your sense of the world that they're in and the messages of the thing and as it pits paganism versus Christianity and doesn't have much time for either of them. And it's a really kind of underexposed gem. It's made by a guy who did a movie called Severance and one other horror film. And Severance played in the film festival a couple of years ago, but didn't play much else afterwards. He's one of these guys like Brad Anderson and a few others, these toilers in horror that almost always end up going directly to video and not getting much screen time. But if and when it comes to Portland, either on disc or on screen, I recommend it. It's a very interesting, unlike the Adjustment Bureau, actually sort of intellectually rigorous for a horror film. And so I give it an A. I think it may go on my 10 best list.
Oh. And you get, I wonder if you get a chance to kick Adjustment Bureau again before the show is over.
Do what?
To kick Adjustment Bureau again before
the
show.
Oh, I'll keep trying. That usually comes to mind.
Drive Angry. So here's your next opportunity because you didn't see this.
I didn't see that. I really wanted to.
Okay.
It's not a very good movie, but I found it worth seeing just because it is such a catalog of all the cliches of this action film and the Nicolas Cage type movie. I actually go into more detail in this in my Vancouver Voice review. Basically, the cliches are so obvious that you can just walk through them one by one and summarize the plot of the movie. But just suffice it to say here that it just has all of these ridiculous cliches. The one good thing about the movie, though, is William Fichtner as the emissary from hell called The Accountant, who has some really choice jokes and has a really great demeanor. And he almost literally is sniffing along after Nicolas Cage, who is, of course, called John Milton, to underscore that he's from hell and it's about the devil. He's literally sniffing him out, going... whenever he's always in the after, but it's not worth seeing, but it is worth thinking about. I discovered, unfortunately, to get to the thinking, you have to do the scene, and it's probably for horror fans. Anyway, I give it a C. It's just average stuff, but I actually got a lot out of it, weirdly. So there you have it.
Do you remember that Gates of Hell movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger where
End of Times?
So that might be right.
End of Days?
Yeah, he goes running into a Catholic church, and he runs in and says, I want to talk about Thomas Aquinas. And all the critics in the audience just lay down and laugh.
At least he may have meant it seriously. I mean, I'm saying this wrong. Maybe he meant it as a joke or knew he was making a joke because he has that great line in not The Last Boy Scout, the last action movie where they show a trailer of Arnold Schwarzenegger in Hamlet. And he asks, to be or not to be? And then he stops for a second, not to be, and blows up something. A very, very funny moment.
Okay. We have about 6 or 7 minutes left. DVDs, any DVDs you've seen lately that are interesting?
Well, I saw the Antichrist DVD is out. It came out a couple of weeks ago. I liked Antichrist when it first rolled around. It's a very difficult movie to see, but there's lots of supplementary material on this that helps.
What's the director's name?
Lars von Trier.
Lars von Trier. This is a really hard movie to watch. You know, it's the kind of thing where I watched the film and I sat there cringing. I guess that's, you know, it just made my skin crawl through the whole film. At the end of the film, I said, that was a great movie. I just can't recommend it to anybody.
Yeah, nails through flaccid appendages. It's hard to take for males or females.
There's so much self-mutilation and other people mutilation in this film. I'm wondering what's going on in Trier's twisted little mind.
Well, interesting. It's such a dense, interesting concept. It's one of the best European films I've seen, you know, a so-called art film since mm-hmm. – The Lives of Others, you know, something where it's so meaty that you just have to think about it. And he obviously did a lot of thinking. Another DVD that's coming out shortly is the Dario Argento film Inferno from 1980, which is obviously an influence on Antichrist, but you don't realize it until you see them somewhat in tandem. And having seen Antichrist and then seen Inferno for the first time on a pretty good transfer disc onto Blue Underground, which does all sorts of drive-in movie revivals, you can see that they're connected, but then also seeing Inferno in the light of Antichrist makes you understand Dario Argento a lot and his suspicion of women and fear of them and other things. And the supplementary material on this disc make that really clear, because apparently he was fighting horribly with his wife the whole time, having screening matches on the telephone, while supposing to be on the set directing the movie. But one of the gems you learn from the supplementary matters.
Like a subplot in a Fellini film, doesn't it?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So if you run out and get Antichrist, which I don't think anybody's going to do, then while you're in the store, while you're in the movie madness, also get Inferno as an interesting additional supplementary bit of material for understanding Antichrist.
Yeah, there are very, very few. This just made me think when you mentioned movie madness. There are very, very few real movie rental places anymore. Netflix is going out of the business. They want you to download everything. Everybody wants you to download everything. Well, if you're not set up to do that and you don't want to watch a movie on a 10-inch screen, the options are becoming quite limited.
The technology is always about 10 or 12 years before poor people. The poor people are finally getting their DVD players just at the moment when Blu-ray and streaming comes out. You know,
the other thing about the Netflix stuff is you don't get the supplementary stuff with most of those discs, and it's kind of especially with the download, you don't.
Well, apparently Netflix and Hulu have both purchased rights to a bunch of criterions, and they're going to apparently include the supplements on the streaming.
Criterion does a marvelous job with old films. People are always wondering what to buy me for, you know, Christmas and birthdays and things like that. And they always buy me movies, which most of the time I have to say go unwatched because I see so many movies as it is. But there's been a couple of sets lately that have kind of interested me. And one is Old Movie Musical, which includes a couple of the early Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers films. There's film noir stuff. They've been slicing it a million different ways. Warner Brothers does it one way. MGM does it another way. Republic does it another way. There's a lot of really good stuff out there and cheap, because if you walk into one of these discount stores, I won't mention a particular brand, but one that has a bullseye, and they always have really, really cheap films. And even the box sets are cheap. This is almost an investment. Because later on, when you can't get a damn movie to watch at your corner store, this would be a good thing to have.
So you're telling the listeners to start lining up to get you some Christmas presents. It's a little early.
Can they just send it here?
I hadn't thought about that, but if that's the subtext, I'm down with that. Yeah. Becky, you seen anything lately on DVD that you're interested in telling us about?
Well, I will tell you that on the 24th of March, the Clinton Street Theater, One Night Only, is showing The Point, the Harry Nilsson movie.
I remember that when it was on TV.
It was like the definition of my, it sort of helped define my personality when I was a kid. It came out the year I was born, and I probably watched it. I've probably seen it 5,000 times.
Gosh.
And yeah, it's kind of terrible. It's like animated in crayon by a four-year-old, and it's narrated by Ringo Starr, and it's, you know, everyone was obviously really stoned the whole time, but it's a lot of fun.
It's very charming.
It's very charming.
Yeah, and what that explains a lot about you.
Yeah, I hope so.
Did you see the Nilsson documentary? Who is Harry Nilsson? Why is everybody
really
talking about?
I haven't yet. I really want to, but I
no. He was a very small part of the 70s for me, but an important one because he did a couple of songs that really reached me, and a couple that made me laugh, including "You're Breaking My Heart, You're Tearing It Apart, So Blank You." He was a boy, the definition of a torture genius who was his own worst enemy. That's Harry Nilsson. Okay, we got about 30 seconds left here. The BAMFest, Becky says go see it. Aaron Mesh is a friend and colleague of ours, and he puts this together. The Adjustment Bureau, I liked it better than Doug. In fact, I like it quite a lot, but, you know, make up your own mind. The Battle Los Angeles, Doug liked it better than I did. I thought it was a bore and not very well done. Hall Pass, yes, no?
No, it's a wait for DVD. Okay. Or, no, wait for streaming.
Okay, Beastly, take your 12-year-old to see it. French Noir, worth your time. Black Death, yeah, and Drive Angry, maybe. Okay, we'll see you 1 month on the third Thursday of the month in April.
Hi, I'm Celeste Carey.
And I'm Cecil Prescott.
Join us this Monday at 8 a.m. when we speak with former Oregon State Senator Avell Gordley about her new memoir, Remembering the Power of Words, the life of an Oregon activist, legislator, and public servant.
Avell will share her life's sacrifices and triumphs. That's an hour with Avell Gordley on More Talk Radio, Monday, March 21st at 8 a.m. here on KBOO Portland.
In the top news this hour, rising radiation levels are complicating efforts to cool down fuel rods at an endangered power plant in Japan.